Psalm 42, of course, the Hebrew word that begins the introduction here, Mashal, for the sons of Korah. It's one of the instructive psalms, as that word means, and there are 13 psalms that are named specifically, Mashal, or specifically for instruction. And this is the second one we've run into. The previous one was Psalm 32. So we'll run into a number of them here in the next group. So basically, they're for instruction. As the hart pants after the roebuck, as the hart pants after the water brooks, I'm getting two animals mixed up here. The hart pants after the water brooks, so pants my soul after you, O God. And here you find the same word that is spoken of as Israel's cry when they wanted to come out of Egypt. The same word is in Joel 1 and verse 20. So it's more than just panting in the sense of being thirsty and really desiring and longing the water, but it's more of a danger of dying of thirst. So it even suggests a cry of pain along with dryness of anguish after water. And that's the way a Christian soul gets in a need for God after it's not been studying and praying and fasting and kind of gotten cut off that way. Now, we noticed before there are several words for a river or stream or waters in the Hebrew language. This particular word, brooks, literally means channels or irrigation pipes or water in gorges that are difficult to approach. So a real fast catapulting stream or vigorous lively water. Then he goes on, my soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? And he's actually, as you'll see as we go on here, describing the long dry spells between holy days. And how, when a person's scattered out, not able to come to church always on the Sabbaths, and they have to wait from feast to feast, how hungry they get for God in waiting from feast to feast. So that's a direct statement about coming to the holy days. When shall I come and appear before God? Seven times in a year you come and appear before God. You remember Deuteronomy 16:16 says. So here he's saying, well, how long is it till the next holy day when I can go back into God's presence? Because to be out here in the world without being in God's presence among God's people at God's Sabbath and holy days is like almost dying from thirst and starvation. And my tears have been my meat day and night while they continually, and that's more accurately translated, all the day. All the day, it seems, they're saying, where's your God? I thought you were one of God's children. I thought you were one of the elect and one of the chosen. And where's your God? So all the day, every day, they're continually saying that. So he's in distress and trouble and eating tears that roll down his cheeks. Then he says in verse 4, when I remember these, I pour out my soul in me, because I've gone with the multitude. I went with them to the house of God, with the voice of joy and praise, with the multitude that kept the holy days. So here you can see the holy days, even there, weren't a yoke of bondage and a hardship and a dread and some kind of an agony. But the holy days were great memories. So at a time when people every day would be harassing him by, where's your God? Then he'd remember how he'd look back and go up to Jerusalem for these holy days with all the multitude that went up to God's house, and how they sang in the journey up, and the songs of ascent as they went up to the feasts, and then, of course, the ritual when they got to the temple and sang on the steps going up to the temple with the multitude that were keeping holy day. So after he looks back and reminds himself again of God's holy days, then he gets after himself and says, well, why, O my soul, are you cast down? Don't let yourself get depressed. Think about the good times and the feasts and when people are troubling you and all the day casting in your teeth like they did Christ, discouraging things and persecutions, then don't let your soul get cast down. Why are you cast down, O my soul? Why are you disquieted in me? Hope you in God, because I'll yet praise Him for the help of His countenance. So apparently he practiced a little bit of self-inspiration there, self-correction and getting after himself and saying, look, there's no reason to get cast down. These people are cut off from God, and you're a begotten Son of God, and you're headed into God's kingdom, and if they martyr you, they can just martyr you right into God's kingdom. So why, O soul, are you cast down? Why are you disquieted? So get back to the hope. Get back to the vision. I'll yet praise Him for the help of His countenance. O my God, my soul is cast down within me. Therefore, I'll remember you when you brought Israel across the Jordan. I'll remember you when they came to the Mount Hermon and from the Mount Mizmar. So think back and remember God's miracles and God's great deliverances of old. And you know, a lot of times that's encouraging and inspiring in your prayers to look back and remember what God did for them of old. And deep calls to deep at the noise of your water spouts. All your waves and your billows are gone over me. Yet the Eternal will command His loving kindness in the daytime, and in the night His song shall be with me, and my prayer, day or night, shall be to the God of my life. I'll say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? Now here again, the word rock is the word Selah, which means a mountain fortress or a mountain crag. Not one of the other words for rock that we saw. Why have you forgotten me? Why go I mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? As with a sword in my bones, mine enemies reproach me. While they say daily to me, they say all day, every day, where's your God? Why are you cast down, O my soul? Why are you disquieted within me? So this is a great psalm to remember when you begin to catch yourself getting discouraged or depressed because of troubles or persecutions. Then Psalm 42 is a good one to remember. And just turn back, and here's a man after God's own heart, and yet he had to get after himself from time to time and say, why are you disquieted? Hope you in God. I'll yet praise Him, who's the help of my countenance and my God. Now, in Psalm 43, of course, here when he says, judge me, he's not using that term in the way we tend to think of it. He's really saying, vindicate me, or get me out of this unjust treatment by other people who are misjudging me. So he's not asking God to judge him there. That's a dangerous prayer. You know, just say, let me have it, God. Judge me. You know, I'm righteous and just come down on me. You know, you wish you hadn't prayed that way. So here he's saying, vindicate me, God. Judge me to show that others' treatments of me are unjust and not fair. Plead my cause against an ungodly nation. And the word there is also the word translated grace, a graceless nation. A nation that doesn't have any grace or charity or forgiveness. Oh, deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man. Because you're the God of my strength, why do you cast me off? Why go I mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? Now, you might notice Psalm 43 had no title to it, so it's actually a continuation of Psalm 42 as far as the tenor, the mood of it, the writer. It's for the sons of Korah, instruction. Although the title isn't there, it goes right along with the previous one. And you can see by the words used in it and the statements in it, you're the God of my strength. Why do you cast me off? Why go I mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? Oh, send out your light and your truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill and to your tabernacles. So there again, it's talking about the holy days. At a time of trouble when you're out in your own area, scattered, and you cry out to God to send out His light and His truth and let those direct you and show you the way to go and protect you, and they'll bring you to God's holy hill again, to the holy days. They'll bring you to God's tabernacles. Then I'll go into the altar of God. When do you go to the altar? You know, that's on a holy day. You don't go there on Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays. You know, you go there on holy days. Then I'll go to the altar of God, to God, my exceeding joy. So there again, you know, when you have the joy of God, it isn't human joy, a human physical pleasure or possession, but when you have God's joy, it's exceeding joy. And Jesus said, "My joy I leave with you, that your joy might be made full." So, my exceeding joy. Yea, upon the harp I'll praise you, O God, my God. Why are you cast down on my soul? Why are you disquieted within me? So you see, that very obviously ties these two very plainly together and written by the same, for the same purpose. I'll yet praise him who's the health of my countenance and my God. So there, three times in those two books, you have that one verse repeated again and again. Now, beginning in Psalm 44, and then 46 and 47 and 48, they're all psalms about how God delivered the Jews from Sennacherib when the Assyrians came down and took the nations of Israel captive, and he chided Hezekiah and said, well, your God isn't any more than the gods of these other nations, so who do you think you are? How are you going to escape? So you might just jot down by the side of 44 to tie it in with 46, 47, and 48. Those three together are called a trilogy, just three that are very closely related about looking back how God delivered Hezekiah from the captors. And of course, in duality, it can apply to the future too, that people are going to be delivered out of a captivity of Israel. Psalm 44, here again for the sons of Korah, and another one of the Mashal instructive psalms, the third one. Of course, too, the chief musician went at the bottom of the previous psalm, as we learned earlier in the classes. We've heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what work you did in their days, in the times of old. Now, when he says, our fathers have told us, it means rehearsed again and again and again. In other words, they were doing what God said to do back in Exodus 12, verse 26. It said, now in days to come, when your children say, well, what's all this Passover deal? What's all this unleavened bread? He said, then you'll tell them what it's all about. Exodus 13, 14, he reminded them again that as their children ask these questions, then they should tell them that. So the Jews to this day, when the Passover season rolls around, they have their kids ask questions. They prompt them and tell them ahead of time, now you kids ask these questions, and then we'll give these answers. So they follow that ceremony today. And the same is repeated in Joshua chapter 4, verses 6 and 7. So he doesn't just make a passing statement here about what the fathers told them. They rehearsed it. They retold it and retold it and retold it. And you know, like when your families get together and you relive the old days and you talk about the old days, and again and again you rehearse and talk about the old days. Well, that's what they did about the works of God. Our fathers have rehearsed what work you did in their days in the times of old, how you did drive out the nations with your hand and planted the peoples of Israel. You afflicted these nations that you drove out, and then you scattered Israel across their land as you chose their inheritance for them, because they didn't get the land in possession by their own sword. So I've got CO written across the first five verses here, if you're marking your Bible the same way. Of course, you'd have holy days in the previous chapter across verse 4 and again with verse 3 of chapter 43 and chapter 4, verse 42. Okay, here is some of the scripture showing the miraculous way God delivered out of war, and not that they fought their own battles for them. They didn't get the land in possession by their own sword. Their own arm didn't save them, but by your right hand, by your arm, the light of your countenance. That was that pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. That was the light of God's countenance. God was present there because you had a favor to them. You're my king, O God. Command deliverances for Jacob. Through you, we'll push down our enemies. So here apparently Hezekiah was stirring up the people to remember what God did of old, so they would be able to deal with the Assyrians that were gathered there around Jerusalem in their day. So when you get in trouble, think back and remember what God did in past times for people in similar troubles. And he's no respecter of persons. You know what he did there, he'll do again. So this is a good example of Hezekiah's prayer when it says he took what Sennacherib said and spread it out before God. This is what he's doing. Because you're my king, through you we'll push down our enemies. Through your name we'll tread them under that rise up against us. I'm not going to trust in my bow. And of course this is the word to have confidence in, the word trust. I'm not going to have any confidence in my own bow. Now David did that when he numbered Israel. And anytime people start trusting in numbers, you know, that isn't what you go by. Neither shall my sword save me, but you have saved us from our enemies. And you have put them to shame that hated us. In God we boast all the day long and praise your name forever. Selah. So there's that word again that's going to connect this first part of this psalm with what's coming in the latter part of this psalm. So he's looked back and remembered what their folks told him forever of old, and then they look at their present predicament and say, we're going to lean on God and not our sword, and we're going to boast all the day in God. Sennacherib boasted in his God. You know, Sennacherib boasted about what all he'd done to other nations and their gods. And so you can see when you read through Psalm 44 and parallel it with Sennacherib's threats and his warnings against the people not trusting this Hezekiah with his words. You can turn back here and read what his words were, because this is it, Psalm 44, along with 46 and 47 and 48. So now he gives you the word Selah. It says stop and review what you've gotten, and then tie that in with what's ahead. So after reading the first part, now comes the opposite on the last half. But you have cast off and put us to shame, and go not forth with our armies. Where are the 10 tribes? They're gone. You know, you've allowed us to get whipped because we hadn't trusted in you, and now you've cast us off and you've put us to shame, and you don't go forth with our armies. You make us to turn back from the enemy, and they that hate us spoil for themselves. Now, the way that's worded, it just means they just spoil as they will. They just plunder at their own will. There's no restraint. There's no power to withstand them. In the verse 9, you'd be better translating, but now you've cast off, contrasting this side of the Selah from the previous side of the Selah. The Hebrew actually is, but now you've cast off. Whereas look what you did of old. Look what you did before. And contrast that with, but now look what you've done. You've cast off in a way of contempt, in a way of putting us to shame, by not even going out with our armies. And here again it shows, when you trust God and your ways please God, then he fights your battles for you, and then if not, why, you go out on your own. You make us to turn back from the enemy, and they that hate us spoil for themselves. You've given us like sheep appointed for meat. You've scattered us among the heathen. You sell your people for naught, and do not increase your wealth by their price. You make us a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and a derision to those that are around about us. You make us a byword among the heathen. And you know, that's a very vivid picture of the way God is having the Jews become in our day, too. Maybe in a way they've come up with power and they've been impressive and the world's kind of stood in awe of the Jewish nation and the way they've been able to deal with all that mass of Arabs all around them. But you're going to live to see this part of this psalm happening all over again. They're going to be made a reproach to the neighbors and a scorn and a derision of those around about them. They're going to be made a byword among the heathen and the shaking of the head among the people. My confusion is continually before me, and the shame of my face has covered me. For the voice of him that reproaches and blasphemes by reason of the enemy and the avenger. Of course, here's Sennacherib that's taking vengeance and avenging and bringing all this trouble on Israel. All this has come upon us, yet have we not forgotten you. Neither have we dealt falsely in your covenant. Our heart didn't turn back, neither have our steps declined from your way. Though you have sore broken us in the place of dragons and covered us with the shadow of death, if we've forgotten the name of our God or stretched out our hands to a strange God, and there the Hebrew word is El, instead of Elohim or Yahweh, shall not God search this out? Now you notice through this chapter, the name used for God, Elohim all the way through here, in the time of Hezekiah and his trouble, and he just uses the name God so far. Shall not God search this out? He knows the secrets of the heart. And here's a verse then quoted in the book of Romans. Yea, for your sake we're killed all the day long. We're counted as sheep for the slaughter. Awake, why sleep you, O eternal? Arise, cast us not off forever. Wherefore hide you your face, and forget our affliction and our oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust. So there again is a good verse for soul. In a time of threatening captivity and invasion and defeat, you could say your soul is bowed down to the dust. Your belly cleaves to the earth. Arise for our help. Redeem us for your mercy's sake. Or deliver us for your mercy's sake. And of course, this is to the chief musician upon Shoshanim, a trumpet showing the trumpet of war and the trumpet of... Some think the word Shoshanim is the word for lilies and suggests springtime and the great Passover season in the springtime. But some say that it's talking about a trumpet, like a lily looks like a trumpet, and it's talking about the trumpet of Sennacherib and him coming against Judah, and Hezekiah's crying out to God and asking God to, why sleep, wake? We haven't forgotten you like the nations that are the ten tribes and the others who've gone into captivity. They went off into heathen religions, but we've gone, kept your religion. Well, they didn't really, but they are right in a way, you know. The sin of the ten tribes was not the same as the sin of the tribe of Judah. They added a lot of legalism to God's way and didn't live up to God's way, although they didn't abandon it. They didn't exchange it for paganism like the ten tribes did. And there again, it's a proof that all the 12 tribes weren't in one nation or one captivity. God prophesied a different punishment for the two because their sins were different. So what you're reading here, Hezekiah said, if you contrast it with the other ten tribes and what they were doing, then it makes it very plain. But you'll see what happens. God does deliver them from Sennacherib. Now, going on in Psalm 45, here again, this one is for the sons of Korah, the third one of those we've run across. Psalm 42 is one of them. And here again, another one of the instructive, the fourth of 13, a song of loves. Now, right here in the middle of this group of psalms that relate to the battle with Sennacherib and the Assyrians and how God intervened when Hezekiah prayed and asked God to deliver them, you have a song of loves. So apparently this Hezekiah put together for his marriage, and it literally ties in with the instructions of a marriage psalm. You'll see in 2 Kings 21 and verse 1, Isaiah 62 and verse 4 about Hezekiah's marriage. And here this comes right in the middle of this chapter. Now, maybe he's saying Christ is going to marry the church if it cries out to God like Hezekiah did, and it'll be delivered from the Assyrian in the future, and God's people will be protected from the captivity of Israel. And there certainly can be a duality or a parallel there very plainly. So now notice the Song of Loves. My heart is inviting, and that word's done a flip-flop in 300 years, because back in that day, the word inviting just meant running over, overflowing, bubbling over. My heart is bubbling over, running over and overflowing with a good theme. I speak of the things which I've made touching the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. You remember Nehemiah said that too, but it just means being ready of mind, being in agreement in your mind with what you're going to write, the subject that you're going to treat, you're in agreement with. So your mind is anxious and eager in agreement to write what you're instructed to write. Now, you wouldn't have the pen of a ready writer if you're going to write lamentations or bad news or doom and gloom, you know, but my tongue is the pen of a ready writer. You're fairer than the children of men. So apparently Hezekiah was outstanding among men and desirable, and not just because of his position as a king. You're fairer than the sons of Adam. Grace is poured into your lips. And you read the grace poured into his lips in the previous chapter. Now, that was quite a prayer Hezekiah gave there in the previous chapter. So this ties even right back to those very words that were poured out of Hezekiah's lips. Grace is poured into your lips. You're fairer than the sons of Adam. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword upon your thigh, O most mighty one, Gibor, or mighty man, as we've read earlier, with your glory and your majesty, and in your majesty ride prosperously, because of truth and meekness and righteousness. So apparently God is, in this Song of Loves, actually showing that God's going to intervene and deliver Hezekiah. And in his majesty, he's going to ride prosperously. And it's because of truth and meekness and righteousness that his right hand shall God teach terrible things with his sword and his weaponry. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies, whereby the people fall under you. And then, of course, it shows he's talking dually about God. Your throne, O God, you're the one that is really winning the battle. You're the one, and it may be referring to God as being fairer than the sons of Adam, but more than likely he's talking about Hezekiah, because he talks about girding his sword on his thigh and grace being poured into his lips, and you know he's the one that uttered those previous words. So here you come with this scripture that's quoted again in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 8 and 9, and actually again some commentators would like to get rid of this as a reference to the Messiah. And yet, if you do that, you've got to rip out Hebrews 1, verses 8 and 9, because they say it refers to that. Also, Isaiah 9, verse 6 is a parallel scripture with this. Jeremiah 23, 6 and Jeremiah 33, 16. And they all have this same theme of these verses here. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your kingdom is the right scepter. You love righteousness and hate lawlessness. The Hebrew word wickedness there is the word resha, lawlessness. Therefore God, your God, has anointed. That's how the name Messiah, the anointed, came to be. So here it's obviously talking about the anointed that loves righteousness and hates lawlessness. The scepter of his kingdom, with the oil of gladness, your God has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions or your fellows. All your garments smell of myrrh, and aloes and cassia. So since your God has anointed you above your companions and your fellows, so that all your garments smell of myrrh and aloes and cassia, out of the ivory palaces whereby they've made you glad, king's daughters were among your honorable women, or the court ladies, or the maids of honor. So apparently when Hezekiah was married, he had other royal women in the wedding. King's daughters were among your honorable women, or your maids of honor. Upon your right hand did stand the queen in gold of Ophir. So here, of course, if it's talking about Hezekiah, and then it's talking about the church marrying Christ when Christ comes back, when the church is delivered from the captivity of the Assyrians, from crying out to God, and so there's obviously a duality. On your right hand did stand the queen in gold of Ophir. So that's a picture of God's church as well as Hezekiah's wife. Hearken, O daughter, and consider plainly, and observe, and incline your ear. Forget also your own people and your father's house. So when someone marries, they leave their father and mother, and they join their husband and start a new family and become a part of his family, and the heirs continually come down through his family from then on. So it showed how strong that actually happened back there. Forget also your own people in your father's house. So shall the king greatly desire your beauty, for he is your Lord, and worship you him. Now here and the daughter of Tyre shall be there with a gift. Even the rich among the people shall entreat your favor. The king's daughter is all glorious within. Her clothing is of wrought gold. She'll be brought to the king in raiment of needlework. So he sounds like a newspaper man now reporting a marriage, telling all her garb and all the bride wore this and the groomsmen's wore this, you know, and except they didn't quite wear it like they did back in that day. Wrought gold. Raiment of needlework. Embroidered robes. The virgins, her companions that follow her, shall be brought to you. With gladness and rejoicing shall they be brought. They'll enter into the king's palace. Now, when I read this, I can see God's sons in the protection and the coming captivity and the church being marrying Christ and all the beauty of that depicted even here. Instead of your fathers shall be your children. In other words, you've forsaken your ancestry and their background. Now, your son, your husband's offspring will take the place of your family you had to forsake, whom you may make princes in all the earth. Your offspring will be princes since you're married to the king. I'll make your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, all the peoples praise you forever and ever. And, of course, this song of loves was sent to the chief musician for the sons of Korah upon Alamoth. Now, the word Alamoth just means relating to young maidens. So it was for a girl's choir or a young maiden's choir to sing this song of loves. Because everybody knows guys don't like to go to weddings and sing songs of loves. But girls just have it in their blood from I don't know how long, you know, that they love weddings. And they love to be a part of a wedding and sing songs of love at weddings. And so God had Hezekiah have this song written for the young maiden's choir, and the young maiden's the same word translated virgin in Isaiah 7:14 that the RSV made such a hassle about, and that the churches attacked the RSV because they translated it virgin, and, or they translated it young maiden instead of virgin. That's really what Hebrew is. They're one and the same, but you know, they didn't have a word for virgin. The word young maiden meant someone that kept herself. And okay, going back now to 46, it picks up where we left off with 44, about Hezekiah's prayer for God to help them. And now he comes back, and this is just a song. Shir in the Hebrew, S-H-I-R. It's one of the songs referred to in Isaiah 38:20. So, during Hezekiah's battle against Sennacherib, and because there's no other period in Israel's history that suits what you read in here, They're not celebrating a victorious campaign. They didn't go out and attack and conquer and defeat, but they had a successful defense. Somebody came on them and tried to overthrow them, but now they've thrown it off. So 46, 47, and 48, the three of them are all intertwined together in what is called a trilogy, T-R-L-O-G-Y, all tied into the same event, and with the word Selah going through. So now he says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be removed, and that's not translated accurately. The word means, though the earth be moved. Same word as verse 6. The heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. Same verb exactly. So you might just draw a line from one to the other to show that they're the same word. So the earth isn't going to be removed. You know, that is contrary to other scripture. So we don't have to fear, though the earth quakes, and it's going to quake and move, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, and here again, same word, moved, into the midst of the sea, or the middle of the sea, though the waters thereof roar, so when you have earthquake and seacoast mountains toss off into the sea, then you have tidal waves. So what he's picturing here is the natural consequence of a quake. The waters thereof roar and be troubled, the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. Selah. So now you're going to see, after he pictured this quaking, now the word Selah is going to connect the roaring of those waters to the silent flowing river underneath Zion, and the raging waters of Sennacherib with the security of God's provisions. But now you notice, after talking about a troubled water with a quake and the mountain falling into it, and we know that could very plainly be symbolical of the book of Revelation, when the old city on seven mountains is going to be quaked off into the sea and tidal waves are going to hit. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God. So notice how the first part of this psalm, or psalm, contrasts with the next. Now here's talking about the river of God. This word river is the word Nahar, N-A-H-A-R, that's constantly flowing river. It's not a wadi that just is intermittent, that flows only in a rainy season. That Hebrew word, this is Nahar, like the Jordan, that flows all the time. There is a river, the streams whereof. So, of course, a river breaks off into channels, and these are streams that are referred to here. And you remember the Garden of Eden had the one river, and it broke into four streams. So he may be contrasting or paralleling that. There's a river, the streams whereof, shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. Now, this is not the word Sukkoth, the Feast of Tabernacles. This is the word Mishkan, that means a place of royalty or a dwelling that's a tent. It can be a tent, but it isn't the word for a temporary dwelling like Sukkoth. So here he's talking about God's stream that's going to be there in the book of Revelation, and that's going to break off into four again like it did in the past. And when Christ steps on the Mount of Olives, you know, a river comes out of there and makes glad the city of God, the holy place of God's dwelling, of the Most High. Of course, Elyon is the word Most High, E-L-Y-O-N. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. So above he talked about a previous kingdom, previous mountains being carried into the midst of a sea, and now after he talks about God's river making glad God's city, he talks about God's in the middle of her. So God's kingdom is going to stand in the middle of the earth, and it's not going to be moved. It's going to be permanent. God shall help her, and that right early. And that right early is just the word dawn breaking, as early as it could be. The heathen raged. The same word as roared, back up in verse 3. You know, if men just translated the Bible consistently without trying to translate it according to what they thought it meant, we could get the true meaning out of it. The word raged here is the same word as roared in verse 3. Though the waters thereof roar, the heathen roared. So he's contrasting the previous verses with these latter ones. The kingdoms were moved. So the mountains were carried into the midst of the sea. The kingdoms were moved. The heathen roared. So God uttered his voice, and the earth melted. So this whole chapter is a millennial chapter. It's talking about what's going to happen when Christ comes back and how the waters are going to go out and water to make glad the city of God. Now, the parallel back in Hezekiah's day, of course, they had this underground cistern that went into Jerusalem, and when Sennacherib thought he could circle them and destroy them, they had living water that went into the city of God, and he couldn't do anything about it. So there's obviously a parallel with what is going to be in the future. God's going to utter his voice, and the earth's going to melt. The eternal host is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge in an impregnable place, what the Hebrew word suggests. It's not the same word as back up in verse 1, refuge. The God of Jacob is our impregnable place, Selah. So here you come again with another one of those connectors. Come, behold the works. The word behold, come, gaze on the works of the Eternal. Stare with amazement. Just look dumbfounded. What desolations he's made in the earth. He makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. It's obviously all about the millennium. And yet it was the takeoff of Hezekiah's day and how God intervened for Hezekiah. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in sunder. He burns the chariot in the fire. Now, one thing we ought to do as we go through, too, is take a good look at the number 3 and see what the number 3 is. You know, man would have you believe the number 3 is a good number. Well, I'll guarantee you, you're reading into the Bible if you try to get a good number out of the number 3. You know, the Son of God was in the grave 3 days and 3 nights. Is that good news? He despised the shame of the cross, and it was the terrible penalty he paid being dead. So you don't find the number 3 as being a good number. Here it's the summary number of weaponry, of destruction, of butchery and horror. And he breaks the bow and cuts the spear in sunder. He burns the chariot in the fire. So you might put the number 3 out beside that part of verse 9, because we're going to notice what, when you find 3 things put together in that sense, they're always a bad connotation. Be still and know that I am God. The Hebrew word be still literally means cease your efforts. Desist, don't do anything. You know, you've done what you can do, now don't do anything. Just cease your efforts and desist. Know that I am God. I'll be exalted among the heathen. I'll be exalted in the earth. The eternal host is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. Now, you've never read a psalm with that many Selahs in it already. But he's just tying together these 3 psalms, 46, 47, and 48. So that Selah leads you right on into the next psalm. These were to the chief musician. Now, Psalm 47, here again, a psalm, mizmor, not just a song. He started off with just a song, and now he has a psalm, mizmor, for the sons of Korah. Another one of those then for the sons of Korah. fourth one of the nine that we're going to run on to. Oh, clap your hands, all you peoples. Shout to God with a voice of triumph. Now, here again is another millennial psalm. So when you're at the Feast of Tabernacles, and you have 1,000 written all the way across Psalm 46 and Psalm 47, you can read and realize what it's going to be like in a few years when the Feast of Tabernacles is fulfilled. Then this is going to happen. Shout to God for the Eternal Most High. Elyon again. The Eternal Most High is terrible. And that isn't the way we mean it today, but he's to be reverenced and feared. He is a great king. See, Sennacherib thought he was a great king. He was a big mouth, you know. He was a boaster. So you can see both the physical and the spiritual duality through this. It's easy to see this as happening back in the days of Sennacherib and how Hezekiah prayed and asked the people to lean on God and he'd get them out of it, and he did. But it can't be limited to the days of Hezekiah. There are parts in these books, these chapters, you can't limit to the days of Hezekiah. For the Eternal Most High is terrible. He is a great king over all the earth. He shall subdue the people under us and the nations under our feet. Now, he did that in Hezekiah's day, but he's going to do that more in your day and my day. He shall choose our inheritance for us, just like he did when the tribes of Israel were to go to the promised land. You know, God chose their inheritance. He picked that out from the days of Abraham and said, look, everywhere you can see, I'm reserving that for you people. And that's what he did with this land we're in today. Of course, Satan came along and tried to make God out a liar by getting other people to migrate there. So when the land God had set aside for the people of Israel, when they got up to Palestine, there were Canaanites in it. And then when Americans and British got to the lands God had set aside for them, they're heathen in it, you know. Canaanites again, actually. But they were Satan's attempt to make God out to be a liar, you know. God said that land was for Israel. So, you know, when I hear people say, we white people took this land away from the Indians and gave them nothing for it, you know, I don't buy that a bit. I taught my kids contrary to that when they got that sad story in school, you know, and they felt sorry for the Indians, you know, and they wanted to imitate the Indians and act like the Indians, you know, and, well, they'd been a great people in their day, but, boy, when you read about what the Canaanites were doing in the land of Palestine, you know, why didn't God let them go in and take the land when Abraham was there? He said the iniquity of the Canaanites isn't yet filled. In other words, they hadn't gone to the place, they couldn't turn around. So God wouldn't be justified exterminating them unless he waited until they'd gone to the place they wouldn't turn around. And they were consecrating their buildings with their firstborn sons. You know, what kind of a religion and practice is that? So I believe what God said in the Bible. Those lands were set aside. God chose their inheritance for them ahead of time and set it aside and preserved it for them. And in the future, he's going to choose our inheritance for us. The excellency of Jacob, whom he loved. Selah. So right in the middle of this little bitty short psalm, he's got another Selah. So after he's telling you about everybody celebrating and rejoicing and all that God has done in our inheritance, now he says, think about that, and then let's tie it in with what's to come. God has gone up with a shout. Now, the statement gone up doesn't just mean in elevation, going up to Jerusalem. It also is the word exalted. It's so translated in verse 9. He is greatly exalted. That same word exactly, gone up, in verse 5. So I just circle gone up and draw the line down to greatly exalted and circle that, and then you know they're the same word. He is gone up and being greatly exalted with a shout, the eternal with the sound of a trumpet. Now that's where the Apostle Paul got that idea in 1 Thessalonians 4 and 1 Corinthians 15, that God was going to go with a shout of the voice of the archangel, with the shout and the trumpet of God. So the whole world says he's coming secretly, you know. And God couldn't make any more noise, you know. He comes with the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God, with the shout. How much more noise can he make? You know, the earthquake, you think about what all is going to come with Christ coming, and the world says secret rapture. Christ coming back secretly. Jehovah's Witnesses say he came back 1914. You just had to have a spiritual eye to see him. Of course, the Adventist said he came back in 1844, except we just misread where he was coming. We thought he was coming to the earthly sanctuary, and he didn't get that far. He just stopped up off there in the heavenly sanctuary. So everybody's got him coming somehow, someplace, all in error, just like everybody has everybody going to heaven one way or another. Well, God is exalted and going up with a shout, the eternal, with the sound of the trumpet, the seventh trumpet. Sing praises to God. Sing praises. Sing praises to our King. Sing praises. And I'll tell you, when you see how bad the world's getting, that wouldn't be too hard to do, to sing praises for God, for intervening and shouting and blasting the trumpet and coming back and taking over. For God is the King of all the earth. Sing you praises with understanding. God reigns and has become the King over the heathen. God sits on the throne of His holiness. The princes of the people are gathered together, even the people of the God of Abraham. Now, notice that. The princes of the people are gathered together. Those are the rulers that God's going to set up over all of the earth. They're called princes because God's really the chief ruler. We're ruling under Him. We're ruling as if we're princes. The princes of the people are gathered together. The people of the God of Abraham, all the dead that are resurrected and all the living that are still alive at that time. When God sits to reign, then He gathers all these people as princes about Him. For the shields of the earth, that's referring to the same princes, the ruling, the defenses or rulers of the earth belonging to God. That's His right and power to give out the inheritance and put in those positions. He is greatly exalted. Now, the last one of this group, Psalm 48, you know, you had a song, then you had a psalm, so now you're going to have a song. So you just, it's beautiful the way God put the Bible together, and again, it's for the sons of Korah. Great is the Eternal, and greatly to be praised, in the city of our God, the mountain of His holiness. So now it follows right on after He comes back and takes over with the sound of the trumpet, and their praises sung to Him, and He's greatly exalted. Now it goes on with that story and tells you what has happened. He's in the city of Jerusalem, in Mount Zion. Beautiful for situation. The joy of the whole earth. Now, there's no time you could have ever said that, but it's going to be said in the future. Is Mount Zion on the sides of the north? So you have Mount Zion on the north of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's on Mount Zion's north side, and then Mount Moriah's even on the north side there on the knob off of Mount Zion. The city of the great king. So here again, another millennial psalm. God is known in her palaces for a refuge. For lo, the kings were assembled, they passed by together. So that's when God judges the current rulers and dethrones them and sends His sons out to rule over them as the princes. Lo, the kings were assembled, they passed by together. They saw, so they marveled. They were troubled, hasted away. Fear took hold on them. Pain is a woman in travail. So you can just imagine, what if Christ came back today and all of a sudden we gathered the Russian leader and the Egyptian leader and, you know, all the leaders around the world. Khomeini, wouldn't that be fun watching him come before God? Boy, it sure would be. You talk about being troubled and hasting away. He'd certainly do that. Fear would take hold on them. Pain like a woman giving birth to babies. That's what's going to happen to the Germans and the Russians and the Egyptians and all the others that are empowered together to destroy man in a battle. You break the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. So apparently the Japanese are going to be in a prominent position in the future. In the old days, that was talking about Spain. Maybe in the end time, it's talking about Japan. As we have heard, so we've seen. So we who are God's people, we've heard all of this. We've already been told. We know ahead of time it's going to happen. So as we've heard, we're going to live and see it. In the city of the eternal host, in the city of our God, God is going to establish it forever. Selah. There again, right in the middle of this psalm. These all alike that way. Now, after picturing more detail the taking over from the human rulers and ruling in the world capital, he depicts, now, we thought of your loving kindness, O God, in the midst of your temple. So he keeps talking about the middle, you know. The mountain went into the middle of the sea, and God's in the middle of his capital and his city. And now God's in the middle of his temple. So they're just stepping in the middle, the middle, the middle. You know, it keeps repeating that word again. According to your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad because of your judgments. Now, daughters of Judah, who are daughters of Judah? Well, Mother Judah was a nation back in their original day in Palestine. The daughters of Judah are the peoples over there in our day. Because of your judgments. In other words, when they see you intervening against all those Arabs that surround them and intervening against all those Asiatic hordes, 200 million, that come to the Middle East and those nations of Europe all allied together, I can guarantee you the daughters of Judah are going to be glad when they see God's judgments on those nations. Because of your judgments, let them be glad. Walk about Zion. You're free to do it now. Just have at it. Just walk around. Go about her. Count all the towers. Observe it. Look it over. Mark you well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces. Tell it to the generation following how God intervened and spared a little podunk country from 200 million Asiatics and 10 nations out of Europe and Muslim Arab millions. Walk around and look at it over and imagine that. You're going to tell that for generations. For this is God, our God, forever and ever. He'll be our guide unto death. Now that's obviously an ending to a group of psalms, because look at the build-up and the climax in that wordage there. And of course that's to the chief musician. Now after God has depicted the taking over and the putting down of all the kings gathered around, of all the humor you ever heard of, now it's a funeral psalm. Psalm 49 is a funeral psalm. The whole psalm, just like we had a marriage psalm, right in the middle of these psalms, now you're going to have it end with a funeral psalm. This one I always use at funerals. It's hard for me not to get worked up against undertakers and funeral directors, where they're taking advantage of the time of people's sadness and soberness and bleeding everything they can out of them. You know, it really antagonizes you to hear them, well, you know, you wouldn't want something cheap, you know. They'd roll over in a grave, you give them something cheap. Well, they're not going to roll over in a grave, you know. I never heard anybody doing that. Nobody's going to roll over in a grave, you know. Who cares how wealthy the vault is you bury somebody in? What's that got to do with anything? But boy, they drain blood out of everybody at time of funerals. So I have a hard time not preaching at the undertakers. And this Psalm 49 makes it easy to do. Now notice what he says here. Hear this, all people. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world. So it's kind of like he said up above, you know. He said, clap your hands, all you people. So he's been talking about all people, and now he comes in with this death knell and this funeral. Hear this, all you peoples. Give ear, all you inhabitants of the world. And here again, this has to do with time, the word world, and not with the system. It has, the Hebrew word is heled, a transitory world, just a particular age. All you inhabitants of this age, both low and high, rich and poor together. And this is an odd terminology. When he says both low and high, the word low is Hadam, sons of Adam, and sons of Ish. So low are sons of Adam, and high are sons of Ish. So maybe that gives us a better idea of how the terms are used through the Bible. Sons of the dirt, or sons of the earth, or the clod, Adam. Rich and poor. Now this word poor is the word for helplessness. E-B-Y-O-N. Hebion. Poor, helpless, together. In other words, give ear all of you alike. Not that they're together in one sense of being there together, but both low and high, rich and poor alike, give ear. All you people are lumped together in those summaries. My mouth shall speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding. I'll incline my ear to a parable. I'll open my deep saying or dark saying on the heart. Wherefore should I fear in the days of evil? When the iniquity, and here's the Hebrew word is perverseness of nature, avon. Wherefore should I fear in the days of evil when the perverseness of my footsteps shall compass me about when they catch up with me? No man, actually the word none here is ish, no man can by any means redeem in redeeming a brother. Now, some people have felt they've perverted this particular verse and try to make it say that's why the Catholics say you can give prayers for the dead, and that's why you can buy indulgences for, you know, you can atone for people's sins who are dead. And yet this verse has been corrupted. It isn't really translated the way you read it here in the King James Version. The verse actually should say, surely no man can redeem nor give to God atonement for himself. That's really what it says in the Hebrew. Surely no man can redeem nor give to God atonement for himself. So there's no verse there saying you can get somebody out of purgatory or be baptized for somebody like the Mormons say. That's why they keep all those genealogy records over there, you know, so they find out whether your ancestors have been baptized or not. And if they haven't been, then you can be baptized for them. So some people get baptized 50 times, you know, for all their kin folks that didn't get baptized. Well, in the New Testament, they got baptized for the dead. Well, in a different sense. For the redemption of their soul is precious. Now, that isn't a sentimental, sanctimonious word, precious, like people use in Protestantism. It's the word in French that means dear or valuable. The redemption of their soul is far greater than any human could ever pay. You know, a human could only pay for his own sin. No human could ever pay for any redemption of his own soul or anybody else's. But the redemption of their soul is valuable, very costly. It's very dear. It costs the Son of God, is how costly or precious it is. And it's been given once forever. The redemption price has been paid once forever. It'll never be paid again. That's what it means there. It ceases forever. That he should still live forever and not see corruption, not go to destruction in the grave. He sees that wise men die. Likewise, the fool and the brutish person perish. So, is that all there is to life, you know, this life? And yet nobody can redeem, no matter how great you get, or how wealthy you get, or how many people you know, or, you know, there's no way you can ever redeem your soul. So you can look about you and observe, as a matter of fact, that wise men die and the fool, and people that live like animals perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations, so they call their lands after their own names. So, you know, here are humans that don't know their purpose, trying to prolong their name and their greatness and their life influence. That's their inward thought. So they name their houses, their businesses, after their names, whether it's Rockefeller or Terror, or whatever it is. Nevertheless, Hanum The son of dirt, being in honor, abides not. You can be president, emperor, Caesar, ruler, no matter who you are. Nevertheless, the son of Adam, being in all the honor, doesn't abide. He's like beasts that perish. They run out of wind and go into the ground and turn back to dust and decay in the grave. And yet, this their way is their folly. They don't ever wake up to why they're here and why we're born and what our purpose is. So this very way of man is their folly, yet their generations approve their sayings. They agree with it and go right along with it and accept it and believe it. Selah. Just think about that. And yet, tie that in with what is coming next. Like sheep that die, they also are put in a hole in the ground. So that's a good example of hell. So any sinner that dies, like sheep thrown in the lake of fire. Who ever heard of sheep being thrown in the lake of fire and burning forever? So now you got sheep in hell burning forever. What'd they do? They didn't sin. You know, they didn't do anything wrong. How can they be in the grave burning forever? But like sheep, they're laid in Sheol. Death, now notice what happens when you're buried in the ground, when you're laid in Sheol, death feeds on you. Eats you up. Just devours you. You decay. You just turn to nothing. But what about the upright? What about people that come to know their purpose? People that come to know God and live God's way and are going to be God's sons. The upright are going to have dominion over all these others who've died and been in the graves and decayed like animals. In the morning when they're resurrected, the upright are going to have dominion over them. Boy, that talks about more than one resurrection, doesn't it? That talks about a future chance for some people who've died. That doesn't teach any Protestant doctrine. It teaches a time when the upright have dominion over these who've died like beasts and laid in the graves and death fed on them, and then in the morning of their awakening and their resurrection, the upright have dominion over them. Well, that's a real golden verse there. I'd write 100 across that, because that's talking about the white throne judgment time. It's sure not talking about, when could it be talking about? And their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, because he'll receive me. Now, this is unusual here. The word receive, it sounds goody like a Protestant term, but it's the same word carry away in verse 17. When he dies, he shall carry away nothing. So when one of God's sons dies, God redeems your soul, your life, your future from the power of the grave. Even though you go back to dust, God's spirit, he takes and he's going to put that in a spirit body, and he's going to carry away you from that grave. That mold of the spirit in man that is really what you are. It's you. Selah, think about that. Now let that really soak in. And then connect that with what follows. So you needn't be afraid when a son of man is made rich. Here again, Ish is made rich, when the glory of his house is increased. Because when he dies, he'll carry nothing away. His glory won't descend after him. So after this life, whatever glory you gain in this life isn't going to descend after you. You won't be president of the company. You won't be mayor. You won't be governor. You won't be chief of police. Whatever glory you carried with you when you went into the ground, you're not going to carry it away with you. You can't take it with you. Now, while you live, if you bless your own soul, men praise you. But if you afflict your soul and fast and strive and grow and deny yourself and bury your old man, men don't praise you when you do that. But when you do well to yourself, men will praise you, because that's what they're doing. But people that die without knowing their purpose, they go to the generation of their fathers. They never see light. They live their whole life in darkness. They're blinded. They never see light. All of their temporary existence, their chemical existence, they never see light all that time. So man, with all of the honor of Alexander the Great or Caesar or anybody, that doesn't understand his purpose, is like animals that have been buried in the ground and death feeds on them, and in the morning of the resurrection, the upright are going to have dominion over them. Now, boy, you talk about a great psalm. That Psalm 49, that's one of my favorite ones. I've learned that one over and over.
I think
we went over it twice. I like it so much, but...